Welcome to the Conventional Sniper Podcast. I'm your sniper, Justin.
I am your spotter, Anthony Sandoval.
What's up, dude? Welcome back.
Wow, thanks.
Been a hot minute. You've been laying low, turd.
Yes, I have.
It's all right.
Found my hindsight, though, so it's time to egress.
Hey, some good stuff coming up with egress stuff. We should talk about, I mean, I know we got a little of agenda, but we should talk about some stuff for civilians in the craziness.
Oh, absolutely. It is some uncertain times laying ahead of us.
Well, let's get through the S2 brief before we do that. I kind of skipped ahead, my bad.
All good, I was just following.
All right, S2 brief. Thanks for those that have supported us and the business thus, this far. Tons of you guys have ordered scope covers, and those seem to be working out well for you guys. Look, just because you buy a scope and you have a great warranty does not mean that your warranty is going to stop you from jacking up your scope. Or is it going to stop your scope from getting damaged? And I know a lot of companies have great, robust testing programs, but I've broken scopes. I think you've broken a few scopes.
I have.
And I've seen at least one hunter every week break a scope somehow. And I'm not saying you guys buy your Walmart cheap scopes, but things break. Made by humans, and things break. And for pennies on the dollar compared to what you spend for optics, you might as well spend a few extra bucks to make sure your good investment doesn't break. As well as making sure that you are not seen if you are a sniper could definitely save your life. So you gotta, hey man, look, just because you bought something doesn't mean it's indestructible. That's all I'm gonna say. But again, thank you for supporting us on that, and thanks for picking up the rear bags. And hey, those are cheap too. They help protect the gun in your position too a little bit, recoil wise, from knocking you around. But anyway, those of you that have shot throughout the year, congratulations on what you've done. Now's the time to reset all your gear with the winter months coming up. Just make sure you're checking out. You know, is that what you want to go into next year? Make sure your gun's clean. Make sure you're planning. Make sure you have a plan going into next season. Speaking of plans, the Armenian War. Let's talk about that. Because I remember we've talked about it a couple of times on this podcast where drones are going to smoke you. It's going to happen. The days of big armor and cavalry movements across open terrain is done. Has been for a long time. However, 80% of all the casualties right now in that Armenian war that pertains to vehicles are done with drones. Supply lines don't exist. You can no longer put yourself behind a HESCO and think that you're not going to get smoked by a drone. You're going to have to be underground, out of sight, out of mind, or in a small element with overhead concealment. Even to some extent, some overhead cover. I mean, bunkers stopped you from getting hit from above. Now you can be observed from above in a bunker. You need to find natural vegetation, i.e. a tree line, or be in a building that has overhead concealment. In this case, concealment is cover. Because if not, that drone is going to smoke you. I was actually watching a drone video the other day, and I think I sent it to you, Sandy. L-shaped trench line, some bad guys in it, I guess. Drone comes over. Smokes an entire trench line with two bombs. There's like 10 dudes in that trench line, gone.
You also look at the ISIS conflict, and even ISIS themselves were taking cheap Chinese-made drones and strapping IEDs to them and doing an incredible amount of damage against the coalition forces. So it's a ever-evolving threat.
Even just at the platoon level, we have Ravens for observation. You think at this point, like you're talking about, ISIS has drones at, I don't want to say their platoon level because they're not an organized army, but at the small, it's no different than you and I would be driving around in a vehicle somewhere and I wanted to get eyes on something, I'd toss a drone out my window.
That's very true. It's a very asymmetrical threat that needs to be recognized, and I believe a lot of that in the planning phase of how individuals should be training for this new, modern fight that's going to be coming ahead of us in the next few years needs to be recognized, and I think there's adapted a lot to? Of yeah, adapted to definitely, and I think there's, I mean, there's the technology solution, technology to fight technology. Is it always going to be available? Is it always going to work? So
the one thing that that I would say drones can't do in this situation is take ground.
It's very true.
You still need a human body to do it, or bodies. The only thing that drones do is soften the defenses of that position you need to take, and or they can help you hold the position. They are a enabler, right? Because let's say for example, if we could have, you know, everyone's seen Iron Man. You know, in Iron Man, he has like those little dart missiles on his arm or whatever. They pop up. I think they're called like sparrows or something like that in the movie, and they zip out and they hit like four or five targets at once.
Yeah,
it's probably going to happen soon on little drones.
Definitely, if not drone swarms, when there's more than one. I'm talking about multiple drones, maybe fitted.
That's coming up.
Kind of like a kamikaze type mission. They literally just get launched to go fly into something to destroy it.
It costs less money to detonate a drone than it does to put another person out to fight another person.
So
you just can't maneuver anymore. And the future of warfare in that aspect is small unit elements, snipers, scouts. Actual scouts, not cavalry scouts, because you can't have cavalry anymore. You really can't. You can't really have it in... And I say this because you're a cav scout. But I guess here, I'll let you defend your guys. Explain to me how cavalry is relevant modern future.
We got really cool hats.
Mistake you for cowboys instead of actual combat units?
More like a peacock. That's okay.
The cavalry branch would be very upset if they could read right now.
Oh, they probably disown me. I spent too much time in airborne, so my mentality of being a true Cav Scout is probably misconstrued.
You are a dragoon, then.
I honestly believe it'll come down to the role. It's going to be a lot more small team maneuvering in these future conflicts. Based on scale, you got to remember that everybody's going to have the resources to be able to produce these drones. And I think a lot of it involves down to the operational environment and what the mission is to begin with. But traditionally, cavalry is, in a sense, was used for large area reconnaissance, zone reconnaissance in particular, to find out where a conventional force is moving.
I could see cav scouts in this reconnaissance role you're talking about, like find where the enemy force is. I could see them taking on that role, where guys now become more, I don't want to say asymmetrically blended in, because I think this is the wrong term what I'm using, but you can't just be like, hey, let's put a squad size element out anymore. You can't. It's going to get hit. Yeah, I would say no more than four-man team size.
It's definitely going to be more complex, for sure, in finding that asset. Because traditionally, you know, the cavalry scout platform unit, a light configuration, you know, usually consists of five gun trucks and no more than 20 guys in a platoon, outfitted to the teeth with cruiserable weapons and being able to use every asset that's available. And that's something that we're always taught, is you never leave assets in reserve. If they're there, use them. So what that future fight's going to look like, especially when these, you know, these drone threats coming up, even more advanced technology with guided munitions, looking at mega cities, underground, you know, the space, naval, you name it. Anything you can think of is going to be coming into play sooner. There's not going to be any stone that's uncovered and being advanced by technology in some form of facet. And looking at that is, I think, on understanding your operating environment and...
The planning process.
Yeah, the planning process and knowing what you can and can't use. And that may develop by trial and error, unfortunately. And if you know, studying history, you're looking back at different tactics and the evolution of warfare. I think one of the first largest ones is probably World War One. And then going back into World War Two, how much the fighting changed from just World War One to World War Two. And we have Korea happen in Vietnam, where we use...
Well, I want to pump the brakes here and bring up a point. And maybe it's a loose point, but I think the learning process can be evaluated from a modern standpoint. Because you look at World War One, where no one had aircraft, for the most part. And then all of a sudden, the aircraft is brought into the equation, and aircraft can study trench lines, and they can, you know, be adapted to have weapons. It's the same concept we have now. The only difference is no one's in the aircraft.
Yeah.
Well, so, and then
even going further, interested, you know,
I bet you if you look at those TTPs though, how they adapted, can probably start to lay some of the groundwork for how do you think about changing your TTPs and adapt to drones.
You know, I think about the bigger, you know, difference between World War I and World War II is, you know, trench warfare. You're moving maybe an inch in several months, fighting against, you know, machine guns of all sorts, large artillery.
It would be a combined weapons. I don't want to, like, you know, you have like combined units, right? Like a mech and a armor unit, but it's
combined arms.
A combined arms battalion. A combined arms battalion now has to have drones for offensive and defensive purposes if they're to survive anything. But again, how do you adapt to that?
I think honestly they're going to rely, you know, technology to fight technology, advancements in electronic warfare. Aerial defenses are going to have to become a huge priority. But this is where I'm getting kind of out on the point, you know, just studying the differences between the two. It's going to be a unique fight.
I mean, it goes to your point that you're going to have to do trial and error, because we were just talking about, all right, we got to have air assets. I've never thought about putting an anti-air guy into a section. Or even in a small reconnaissance team, like a recce team, we'll say. And I guess we could say the recce team in our terms of the conversation here is the same thing as a scout, a recce, like a reconnaissance guy, right?
Yeah, I think the future platoons are going to become more dynamic, or sections, however they're going to operate, just based on the type of equipment you're going to have, you know, facing a very advanced force. And you mentioned the Armenia and the Azerbaijani conflict, and if you look at the two countries, I mean, yeah, Azerbaijanis have a lot more resources available, and Armenia, if you guys are familiar with doing Pemisi studies, Armenia really relies on everything else for outsourcing to be able to run their country. They don't produce very much either, so comes to show that they're not very militarily advanced, and getting defeated by a small amount of drones, almost initially annihilated.
Yeah.
Kind of shows what the advancement of technology and the capability versus just traditional fighting style, or relying on that armor movement or conventional, what we would still call conventional type fighting. And that's what I think you mentioned something to me, about an incident, about some event that was happening in Jaegershot 2020, about a certain lane in training style. And, you know, for the last 10 years or so, it's been, oh, let's get back to the basics. But then we're doing full-spectrum operations.
The basics have changed, though. That's the problem.
Exactly.
The basics are new. You have new basics. The basics is you got to have stock lanes with drones. You got to have a movement. And I would even say, let's just say at the conventional company size element. Let's say the company size element is just going to practice stick lanes, and it's going to be a movement to contact or movement to seize ground, right? Because I think movement to seize ground should be a battle drill. It's, think about it. You either have movement to contact or break contact. Where is movement to gain ground as a battle drill? That's not a battle drill. But at the planning process, that has to be a battle drill. Because we know the planning process at the conventional level usually is part of, it starts from the brigade at the strategic level, right? And it trickles down. Well, the battalion and the company levels have to think of a movement to seize ground. And that begins their backwards planning process so that those at that level can see how their picture fits, or their puzzle piece fits into the larger strategic piece. And that movement piece, movement to seize ground, needs to be part of how do we deal with drones.
Yeah, I definitely would include that. And like I said, studying history, I mean, going back to the beginning, it's always been about having the key terrain and seizing the ground, holding the ground. If you look back at our lessons in Vietnam, our victory was measured in kill count. What happened when we fought for days and lost, had numerous amounts of casualties to take a certain hill, seize the hill, then leave.
And you know what? I'm gonna argue to say that we won Vietnam. And I'm gonna here, ready? I got this argument. So when we signed a peace treaty with North and South Vietnam, right? We had brought North Vietnam to the table to negotiate a peace with us. That is by all accounts winning. You fought, forced another military, and because there is a North Vietnamese army, and a guerrilla organization, the Viet Cong, to come to a bargaining table for them to secure peace. Like, we're going to split this country no matter how many guys you fight and throw at us, politically or not. That's a win. You've stopped a war. You've won the war so much that the enemy forces cannot maneuver, right? But we can still maneuver. Politically, we're holding ourselves back. But as far as it contains arguing with the enemy, whether it be direct conflict or through negotiations, or political, you could say, we've stopped them from being able to wage a war by bringing them to the bargaining table, which is, in theory, a W. It's a win. You've stopped the enemy from being able to fight. They have no choice but to negotiate a truce, right?
Or is it a stalemate that's never ending?
I mean, you could say that. Would you say that we won Korea or lost Korea?
I think we lost the political objective in Korea, but we won by having the ceasefire along.
Well, then that same argument, and I don't mean to cut you off because I got you right now. I got you on the hook. By winning the ceasefire in Vietnam, we won the same thing. We won the ceasefire. It wasn't all. We didn't lose. Once we said, "All right, the peace terms are negotiated. We're withdrawing." Right? It's part of the peace negotiations. And as soon as we withdraw, North Vietnam began its initiation to overrun South Vietnam. Right? And we said, we're not helping you, South Vietnam. We've stood them up to that point to say, you should be able to hold your own right now. We can't help you anymore. You got to do it on your own. And this is where I think a lot of the political stuff gets lost in Afghanistan. We've stood up the Afghan army well enough to defend on their own, and they still cannot continue to do it. That's their own problem at that point. Strategically, we have stood up an army for you. And here's where it grinds my gears about looking at history is you have to understand that if the army you're standing up eventually doesn't want to do it, that's on them, not on you. You can't lead a horse to water and force it to drink.
That is true.
I would say Vietnam-wise, we took the W.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're also looking at the political end state, too, constantly changing every change of... That's the big thing about the long wars as well. Is it's not like you have a... In our democracy, it's not like we have a king that's going to reign until they die. It's ever-changing key players. So that political end state is always changing. Well, what was our objective in Afghanistan? What was it originally? What was it at the end point? What is it now when we said we're going to withdraw 10 years ago? So I guess, yeah, I'll take that in as a valid statement for a win. Are we getting out of there? We did what we could. And if they don't want to do it on their own, it's on them. We kind of did the same thing in Iraq, and look what happened there, though. So,
and they asked us to come back in instant and help them secure themselves again. That's what, you know, you play games with people in the political sense, and that's what happens. That's where I think America just got tired of it. Just like what's, you know, we talked about earlier in the podcast about uncertain times. And I've been kind of toying, and not to switch top subjects here, but I've been toying with this in my head, and I know I've texted you on it a couple times, like, what is, like, the SPR, the Special Purpose Rifle, right? Because us as reconnaissance guys, as great as the podcast is at times, I'm like, how do I relate to the civilian guy that's, he wants to shoot PRS, he wants to be the sniper guy, but at the same time, he wants to, like, do self-defense stuff and relate all this reconnaissance stuff to the local situation in America, right? I don't know how to say, like, hey, don't take a bolt gun. Like, hey, PRS guns are freaking heavy at 15 to 18 pounds.
Yes.
You know? Absolutely. I mean, you've got, like, the Sig Cross and some other really light guns, which are great, and I agree with them, but you just can't beat a semi-automatic platform. You really can't. And to further put this into real-world experience, and here's where I think conventional guys actually have a better opportunity than SF guys to teach things, And this is where I think it's getting lost, and that's why I don't really bring a lot of SF guys on. As great as their aspects are in unconventional warfare and standing up networks and doing all that stuff, you get it's that's like playing three-dimensional chess. Okay, I'm going to put this in an analogy here, I think is the correct term. And then you get the conventional guy that just has to play chess, right? You're at an area for a year, 9 months, right? You know all the local villages, you know the political climates, but you can't really be like an SF guy and change things. You have to kind of learn to adapt to the way the locals are a little bit, but at the same time also play the political game, right? So as a young conventional guy, I have to find a way to maneuver in around the battle space and figure out who the bad guys are and the good guys are. And I don't have money or I'm not trained in that specific area, right? And if you look at the Ranger bat guy, that dude's playing checkers. Comes in, hits a target, gets out of there. Us, you and I can, I think, more relate to the local guy who's got to stay here. He can't just leave and go. Budgets are up and down based on what you do for a living, your education. That's very much like living in a deployment area.
Resources are getting scarce.
Right. You know, not like I'm not an SF guy where I make millions of dollars and I can just go buy a Mark 19 for the hell of it because, you know, Second Amendment. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think conventional guys can relate to more in these situations. And one of the things I talked to you the other night about is, what is the perfect gun system for a guy that has to be able to engage inside his house, but yet also be able to maximize the weapon's capability? And I think we talked about the evolution of the carbine, right, in 14 and a half inch guns. Right, and I think there are some other aspects to this that I put off a long time about getting into this topic because you can just go down a really deep rabbit hole, but I think it's time to bring it up. And like low power variable optics is a big thing. Offset red dots are a big thing. Suppressors are a big thing. Sorry about the growling in the background, it's my dog. those sort of things I think are important. So I guess, how would you, in a civilian sense, consider, what would you consider a carbine?
Carbine for me would just be a standard AR platform, 5.56 or other caliber. Think about honestly, for me, it'd be the easiest access to ammo, affordable ammo. So I'm running around shooting 6.5 Grendel or...
That's not affordable.
308 or 300 Blackout. I mean, it's already been hard to find before the hot buying of ammunition like it's toilet paper again. So just standard 223, 5.56, it works. It's been working for
what grain time. Would you go with?
Or honestly, if you
what grain and barrel length?
If you're gonna do for me, if you're not gonna try to play the game with getting around the SBR thing and doing the AR pistol deal, 16 inches will make it work, right? If you suppress it, you're only adding length. But ideally, a 14 and a half is, I think, the perfect middle ground. Going any shorter, yeah, you're going to be great at room clearing, but you're going to have a hard time engaging targets out past 300 meters or roughly over 280 yards with a short barrel rifle. Yeah, can you do it? Absolutely. But what's truly your max capability, right? It's over 600 and beyond. So a 16-inch gun with a 1/9 twist would be perfect for, 62 grain. M855.
What about a 77 grain? I've actually seen a lot of guys say, I'm going to run 77 grain for home defense, and I'm going to put it in an 11.5-inch barrel.
It's honestly not going to do you any good because by the time you would need that extra weight on that green inch, you're not going to have enough twist on that fucking round to be able to hit what you're trying to get at anyways. Basically, you're going to be paying more for that ammunition with little...
At that point, you might as well just go 300 blackout you're going to run an SBR. Well, and I'll say an SBR is anything below 14.5. To no shorter, and I mean no shorter than 10.5. Because I know guys like to run 10.5 inch, guys run 11.5, 12.5. I, as a carbine guy, would probably take a 12.5. And I know there's someone's gonna be like, oh, you're overgassing this, or you're overgassing that, and you're gonna wear out your guns faster. I got it. I'm gonna take a 12.5 and I'm gonna suppress it to bring it up to about 15 inches. And I think that's the, and I'm saying that like most suppressors are probably around 5 or 6 inches. You know, I want something that at 12 and a half, I can reach a little bit further, but I also want something that if I have to go into a house, I'm not getting stuck playing games with corners with barrels. And here's another topic I want to bring up with you, because we discussed it last night when I was on my way out of the house about like slow is smooth and smooth is fast. And it's a weird topic because we've been told about it for our entire career that slow is smooth, smooth is fast. But there are times that I grasp with, are we training the right way in using that verbiage? Because I see, and here's where I think the industry is forgetting a term here, and that's violence, right? So we do tons of drills. But by the way, don't worry about the kids in the background. You know, we got adult lives.
I apologize.
That's why my dog keeps growling. You know, hey, life's a beach. You gotta make it work, right? So we talk about violence, and I think this is where the drills that came from with a beeper or a timer are trying to bridge that training gap between you as a civilian versus our combat experience and a guy that knows how to kill you, right? The buzzer is supposed to, when you hear the beep and you draw your gun out or you bring it up to the ready up and you begin to engage, it's because you're supposed to be violent in your movement techniques and your engagement process, meaning overwhelming superiority in fires. You are putting more rounds on target than the enemy can put it on you. Let's say you're defending your house. And that's what that buzzer's for. Hey, engage multiple targets as fast as possible. But you're not understanding the mindset of being violent. That's what that is supposed to bridge the gap for. You need to kill them and be violent.
Fast and accurate, right? So that's what I was going to say. Thinking about it is, when you hear that definition, slow is smooth, smooth is fast, what does that really mean to you? To me, I used to think it of as, you know, that's how you succeed. You got to be, you know, slow things down. Don't overrun yourself to where you make mistakes. Well, in training, that's a good thing. You want to make those mistakes, right? So if you think holistically at outcomes-based training, outcome could be anything. I'm going to use, for example, I want to do one shot with my AR on a 6-inch target at 50 yards in under 10 seconds. While switching to my secondary weapon, firing two rounds.
Yeah, once the gun runs dry, switch to sidearm.
So one round, right? One round of magazine, fire one shot, center mass, 6-inch diameter. Switch my secondary weapon, fire two shots, assess, reload, and fire three rounds out of my rifle again in under 10 seconds. Well, you start to race yourself. If you ever do it, like 10 seconds, it seems... yeah, fairly fast for others, and for some it's no time at all. But when you try to put all those pieces together, all those moving pieces together, you will find an error. You might fumble something. You might not drop a magazine or have to yank it out or those issues. So, and what it really comes back is for me, when I think this slow is smooth, smooth is fast, is I'm going to try and do it as fast as I possibly can and find the mistakes, right? And that's where it comes to performance-based training. I'm going to eliminate those areas and focus on, okay, I'm making a mistake here. I'm fumbling with grabbing a magazine in my magazine pouch, or I'm having a hard time finding my magazine well, or I completely missed my bolt catch release on my AR.
I forgot to turn the safety on or off.
Any of those things, right? So slow is smooth, smooth is fast. Okay. At that point, yes. For me personally, that's where I think it makes sense. Okay, now I'm trying to focus on the performance measure. I'm going to slow it down. I'm going to get it down right, develop a rhythm, get that base foundation, and then I'm going to speed it back up again, right? And once you're successful at that, how can you improve? Decrease the target size and increase the distance, right? Or decrease the time and just continuously make it harder and harder and harder.
Yeah, you just got to keep in mind, I think, that you are training to be violent. You are training at that point with the buzzer to A, know your equipment, because when it does go chaotic in a very dynamic environment, your mental pathways are going to retract so bad that you're not going, you're building, what's the word I'm looking for? that secondary, it's right on the tip of my tongue, man. You're trying to make it second nature. There we go. You should be able to do things with your eyes closed, but at the same time, your brain is slowing that stuff down, right? So if I'm training to go fast, and I can do it with my eyes closed, that's because I'm preparing for that adrenaline rush. And here's where I think the difference between gaming and training come into play. The gaming helps you get to know your equipment, but what does training do in bridging the gap of when your adrenaline dump happens in your head, right? And that vision comes down a lot. You know, I'm going to equate this to a way of like, you ever play football?
Yeah, of course.
Right? You ever go to a bunch of practices during the off season and you think you're good, and then the first time you get slammed by some dude in a game, and you're like, you know, maybe football's not for me. You ever had that a couple times? Or you're like, wow, that dude's going to wreck me pretty hard.
Well, I guess I had a little bit of different experience. I was a small dude. I always got wrecked by all guys.
Yeah, so that's the way a gunfight is, I guess, taking the adrenaline out of it. Like, mindset-wise, you're like, all right, I got my equipment. I trained. I'm super fast on the gun. And then the first bullet flies by, you're like, oh, hey, that guy can actually kill me. And maybe I didn't train well enough. Maybe I didn't train hard enough, right? And that's where I think the difference between the game and the training comes into play. And I think the buzzer is just kind of a way to bridge that gap a little bit. But I think people are forgetting that just because you're running a buzzer and posting it on Instagram, are you really in the violent mindset? The mindset to survive the day. Because at the end of the day, that rifle, that perfect setup you've built for yourself, is the tool so you can survive another day. It's not a game. Like, no. Combat will kill you.
I definitely think...
someone's going to die in it.
Yeah, definitely. There's no... I mean, that should be the outcome. If someone shoots at you, and I'm gonna try to kill them before they kill me.
And I think this is where the carbine, and I guess you call it a recce setup, comes into play quite well, because me as a... And I have to give it to the Law Folder guys, and I think it's 17 Designer Manufacturing. They make a foldable stock on the carbine or on the AR platform. Law Tactical has like the adapter piece that goes on, and 17 Design and Manufacturing makes it to where the folding piece for that adapter is actually inherent to the lower receiver.
Yeah.
Right? So it actually shrinks the overall profile of that lower receiver because it's not an addition onto, it's incorporated in. And I think it's like, it's not much as far as big measurements go, but in packing into a backpack, it actually makes more sense to me. And it's just, it's weird how gear selections actually kind of change. And I don't mean change subject again. I know we're kind of all over the place, but as a civilian, I'm not going to wear a battle belt. I'm not going to wear a helmet. I'm not going to wear knobs. I just got a gun and some ammo. And it's going to happen to you probably when you're least expecting it. You're sleeping, probably getting up in the morning. You're just coming home, something like that. And you're not going to be kitted out. You know?
Oh, in a perfect world, we would be, right? But,
I mean, I don't want to wear a body armor every day for the rest of my life.
Be realistic. Murphy owns the day, right? Three rules of Murphy. Don't zig when you're supposed to zag. Don't go left when you're supposed to go right. And don't jump when you're supposed to duck. he's always going to win. You're right. I ain't going to wear body armor for the rest of my life. Every day in, day out.
Maybe I'll just have a carbine.
Being able to pick up on those signs, your environment, and kind of know when something's not right. But
yep.
Instead, we're getting off subject there.
Think we're getting off subject, because that's kind of equipment selection, too. You know, I'm not going to run around with an AR-15 strapped to my back all the time.
No.
You know? And, I mean, I know that gets into pistol selection and concealed carry stuff, and I don't really want to dive into that. But I think there's a big difference between you buying the latest, greatest hot gear because it's operator worthy versus, I mean, even then, playing chess versus checkers in patrolling, let's say. I mean, if I'm a section sergeant somewhere, I shouldn't be buying Cry Precision, you know, plate carriers that have the little zipper things on the side so I can zipper like my 3-day or 1-day assault pack on the back. Not just no, but absolutely goddamn no. And I know I see all these dudes in BAT and SF everywhere buying this Gucci Cry gear because it's got zippers and you can put your stuff on. I don't know who forgot how to do long-range patrolling, but I am not zippering anything to my back. Not even just going hunting as a regular hunter. I'm not zippering anything to there.
That's kind of the thing, too, with the social media presence as well. It is awesome looking and cool and, like you said, Gucci. But knowing your role, if you're not in that job doing hit-and-run raids or...
on a SWAT team.
Or on a SWAT team.
Where you have a vehicle and you're going to be there for a couple hours max.
Yeah.
Maybe 4 or 5 hours. And then guess what? You don't need to bring an assault pack. You have a vehicle.
It's knowing your role. And obviously, gear selection comes down a lot to mission stuff. Your operating environment, knowing what's there and what's not. You know, everyone forgets that the enemy also gets a vote, too. So,
That's one thing. Like, I see guys like, oh, you got to carry a tourniquet on you everywhere you go. I'm like, no, I'm not carrying a tourniquet.
I know how to feel expedient tourniquets.
And I know someone's going to be like, hey, you should be carrying a tourniquet. If you can make holes, you can plug holes. That is true. I can make and plug holes. But you know what I'm not going to do as a single dad? I'm not going to carry a tourniquet. I'm not going to carry a fixed blade. I'm not going to carry a freaking searchlight on me. I'm not going to carry a pistol. And I'm not going to carry a rifle in a backpack with me. The rifle is going to stay in my vehicle because I'm not going to be up for 4 or 5 days. I don't need to carry that. It's too much weight. And here's where it comes into that gear selection process to you as a civilian. Why do I need to carry an assault pack with a rifle? The pistol is I want to avoid gunfights as a civilian in any facet of the environment in any country because I'm always going to get outgunned no matter what, right? Because criminals usually run in packs, in pairs, usually. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 guys, that's usually how it works. Especially in big city areas, no one's going to run by themselves because it'll be outgunned. All my pistol's there to do is to get me back to my vehicle and for me to get the hell out of there and call the cops. That's it. And it's not to call the cops because I think that they're going to bring a gunfight. It's because I need someone who has more assets to help get me out of there. And also, I don't want to go to jail. You know? I don't want to be in a gunfight. And this is where that reconnaissance background comes in the same play, like, you got to know your role and where you are in your environment. And you got to know your environment's, what's the word I'm looking for? Not condition, but like,
you have to know the most,
like,
you have to be able
posture
to
and mood.
You got to be able to identify the threat level, right? Are you in a permissive environment where it's normal everyday life and everything's kosher and good and you can roll around with, you know, with nothing and then, you know, when you're going maybe to a certain area that's kind of sketchy, like, all right, maybe I'm going to carry you today.
Or why do I need to go there?
Yeah, that's also a big reason, too. Why do I need to go there? Most of us...
Is there something I can order online instead of driving there?
Exactly. But sometimes those things are unavoidable. Like, you know...
Sometimes you're just in the wrong place.
Going to a VA healthcare because it's in, you know, the locations they are. Sometimes it's a little sketch. And then, yeah, you're like, yeah, all right.
Maybe I should have a gun. I got it. But I'm not going to carry 10,000 pounds of fighting equipment on me.
No. But slow is smooth and smooth is fast, remember?
You got to make sure
walk around like a Ninja Turtle loaded up from head to toe.
Might as well just wear a Jang-on blanket on top of you because you're going to have to carry all that other crap on you. That's, like, I don't want to... I hate having to select clothes for concealed carry. I just want to wear normal, comfortable clothing and maybe carry a pistol. That's it. My job also is not to be a medic.
No.
My job is to avoid the gunfight, protect my family because I don't have overwhelming odds and fire superiority. I don't want to be in a gunfight. I want to avoid it as much as possible.
That's why we always had that rule. Seeing scouts a dead scout, and I'm sure you guys are the same thing. Being compromised.
A seen sniper is a dead sniper.
Pretty much. In our role and what we talk about, especially on this podcast, is you're supposed to be the unseen, and if you are compromised, you better be able to have the ability to be able to fight out, with violence.
Yep, and that's where that buzzer, and hey, the thing is like, when it comes to the law, I don't think you should at all ever advance on a target, because from what I understand from the law, I'm by no means a lawyer. As soon as you begin to advance on a threat, you now become the aggressor. Right? Now you're aggressively attacking someone. Nope. I want to get away from them. Right? And that's where maneuverability comes to the aspect. And, like, if I'm wearing a suit or wearing a pair of shoes and some running shorts, I should be able to find the quickest egress out of there to cover and concealment.
Yeah, it's kind of where you're, growing up in a military background, especially if you're combat arms of any type, always close with and engage the enemy. When it comes to self-defense, it's always it's the opposite. You want to try to break contact as much as possible, mm-hmm. because if you enact on your natural instinct to train, or on your training, and you close with, you're right, it starts to be looked at the other way in our eyes of our laws as the aggressor. So it's a twisted backwards world, because I know it's not some of our, some of us have that, it's just so ingrained in there that is the reaction. It's not even, there's no thinking about it. That's just, you react to it, just like a battle drill. You don't have to have the thinking process. You just do.
That's good. That's good and bad. And I know I see a lot of guys like going to these carbine classes. We're like, all right, let's maneuver around the vehicles and get your targets and flashlight this. And absolutely goddamn not. Like, that to me is a tactic. And I can tell you right now, there's a lawyer that's going to hem you up when you get to that point. You want to get away from the gunfight as fast as possible. And distance negates skill. Whether that guy's got a knife or you've got your fists, get out of striking range of whatever object that person has or tool they have to hurt you and maneuver away from. Right? Lateral movement isn't a maneuver away from. If that guy continues to pursue you, continue to defend yourself. It's pretty simple. I mean, gear selection, and I kind of go back, gear selection should have to be how you don't necessarily want to get into a fight. What gear am I going to carry on me that allows me to get away from the fight? And that's not a coward move, because it's ensuring that you get to fight another day. My eyes are a better piece of equipment than anything else.
This is also supposed to be civil society, too. This isn't a war zone. So,
but, my eyes are the best piece of equipment I could ever
have. But how do you best train for that? And my idea is you train for your specific role in your job. You be able to have that balance of action, that speed and surprise element by being lethal at no matter what distance you're at, whether you're breaking contact or you're closing with the enemy. In a civil, just as we were talking about, in a civil society where we're faced by a threat and we have to use lethal force, trying to break contact and get away from the force is only going to add in your favor. And being able to effectively engage a target at any distance, even if you're trying to get away, is only going to save your ass in the legal fight.
It's true. I mean, that's no different than you being in a regular section and you choose to engage someone because you think they're about to hurt someone, or you know that that's the enemy. Guess what you're going to have to do? An intel debrief. And guess what? A lawyer is going to go over that. A JAG lawyer is going to go over why you killed someone. It's going to happen.
Yeah, and depending on the ROE, it's always, and I understand, fear of life, limb of eyesight from yourself and from your comrades. Not necessarily to be concerned with the civilian populace and whatever area you're in.
I mean, it's definitely a consideration, but...
It is consideration, but it's...
Save your own hide first.
Yes.
But, I mean, to kind of go back to that gear selection stuff, and I want to hit on it because I see a lot of dudes in the community space like we are right now. They forget that gear, over time and distance, will begin to hurt you depending on what you select. Ruck selection, is a huge component. And the other thing is what gear you carry on you. In that ruck, you got to carry food, you could carry water, you carry first aid, you got to carry radio batteries and crap. You buying the latest Gucci gear is not going to help you unless that gear does, in my opinion, this is the only exception, that piece of gear does multiple things in one.
Yeah. Well, like I said, if it fits your specific role for what your job is and what you're trying to achieve, then perfectly fine. But if you're a normal conventional guy... on a 3-day patrol, your 1-day zipper on assault pack is probably not going to cut the distance. So no matter how much money you spend on it and how much you want to look at being tactical.
And your body's going to hurt for it. Your body will not like you at all in the next 3 days.
I don't think your guys are going to like you either when they have to carry extra shit for you.
Well, that's true. But that's true.
No one wants to have to do that. So,
no, it's true. Anyway, we're getting close to 45 minutes. We should probably wrap it up, huh?
I think we should, you know, kind of go back full term. We're talking about carbines. Honestly, I think in my eyes, if you're going to use a carbine for a platform for defense or whatever it is you're trying to achieve as a selection for a special purpose rifle, being able to gauge out to 600 meters, 600 yards, wherever you want to put it, is probably the most ideal. So running it, like you said, a short-barreled SBR with 77 grains, probably not going to... The heavier grain is not going to do much but hurt your bank account, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not that's true. I'd probably go no shorter than 12.5, suppressed, because I don't want to blow my eardrums out. And let's be honest, no one walks around with hearing protection on.
And don't forget in the training aspect too, man. It's always good to criticize. You know, everyone's doing the whole fancy video thing on Instagram, and there's wonderful apps out there. There's Coach's Eye, where you can video yourself and draw lines and be able to criticize. Peer criticism is good. And I know some people don't take it well, but we do it all the time. We're always giving each other crap. And I know when Justin's definitely getting hyped up and he's about to spin in circles and not know what he's about to do next. And then I have my moments where he's like, you know, you jerked that. I'm like, yeah. I'm a carbine guy and he's the long gun guy. So that's why normally I'm the spotter, because I'm learning the back-assers way.
I mean, you've gotten better at spotting. I'll give you that.
Well, thanks. It's been an educational learning.
Yeah, I guess you're not too bad for an airsofter.
So... I only have those.
So, anyway, guys, we appreciate you listening. You know, we'll touch base more on the carbine stuff here soon. I just bought some night vision. We'll probably go over that a little bit, because I think one thing in coming up with night vision is, how do I observe at night through a spotting scope? You know, and I know there are a ton of weird methods to do it, but also I don't see any nighttime precision rifle courses, I do see some, I should digress, but I also don't see any nighttime competitions. I don't see any nighttime competitions where they include a stock lane on the extreme circuit, we'll say, with drones. Like, if competitions want to push the industry and they want to push teams, you need to go over that stuff. So, we'll come back on it. Also, a couple more things before we close out. If you are still using the OSOC apparel code, Sniper Podcast, it's still good to go as far as I'm aware. Also, I want to send a quick shout out to the Snake Pit Podcast guys, Mason and Dave over there. Pretty good dudes, both qualified snipers, both section guys. If you use the discount code Snake Pit on our website and you listen to their podcast, and get yourself 10% off. And yeah, I guess other than that, we appreciate you guys listening in, and we'll put some more podcasts up soon. And we apologize, there's been a lull. We've been busy with all the covers and some other stuff, so we're getting there. We're getting back to it. So I guess in closing, from the tall grass, one shot.
One kill.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.